Are you into crossword puzzles? They might seem like an idle pastime, but they often reflect broader social trends. At the intersection of language and culture, puzzles say a lot about who we are, and they're often anonymous creators, in a way are creating a record of our shared popular knowledge. One puzzle maker offers this insight in the new book, The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle by Anna Schechtman. Anna teaches at Cornell University and creates bi-monthly crosswords for The New Yorker. She's also written for outlets like Art Forum, The New York Review of Books, Slate, and The Los Angeles Review of Books, where she's an editor at large. Here's Anna to share five of her key insights.
My name is Anna Schechtman, and I'm a writer, soon to be Cornell English professor, and a crossword constructor for The New Yorker. Sometimes, although rarely with a straight face, we call ourselves cruciverbalists. My book, The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle, is admittedly a strange one. Personal and panoramic, historical and at times theoretical, it wrestles with the history of the crossword puzzle to consider the gender politics of language. I'm going to share with you five insights from the book that I hope will pique your interest. Insight 1. This book tells a history of the crossword puzzle which surprisingly intersects with the history of feminism. Between 1913, when the puzzle was invented, and the 1960s, most crosswords were created by women, often bored housewives with college degrees that they otherwise weren't putting to use, women who wanted careers but, before the second wave, not the social stigma of being career women. Now, more than 80% of crosswords are created by men. There are at least three causes for this masculinization of the industry. It's partly a function of a changing workforce. As more women enter the labor market and were still expected to do the large share of housework and childcare, few had time for this rarefied, low-wage puzzle work. It's also informed by the impacts of computing on crossword construction and the invention of the nerd stereotype, both of which have reshaped the demographics of the cross world, as we sometimes call it, in the image of Silicon Valley. My first experience of the gender gap in the world of puzzle making was after I published two crosswords in the New York Times at age 19. I began to be known among other constructors and puzzle editors, but not just as a puzzle maker, as a woman puzzle maker. I was solicited to create puzzles by male editors looking to diversify their bylines, and in 2014, Will Shortz, the longtime editor of the New York Times crossword, asked me to be his assistant. It was an incredible opportunity, but one that also sensitized me to the politics of the puzzle. My gender difference informed my sense of what were good and bad puzzles, what words were worth including in the page's grid, and what weren't. Shortz edits up to 95% of the clues in a Daily Times puzzle, so we spent most of our days free associating together in his home office, writing clues and rewriting them. Our worldviews were markedly different. He, in his 60s, is from rural Indiana. I, then 23, am from Lower Manhattan, but one of the largest sources of static in our communication was gender. Is the term male gaze, for example, puzzle worthy? Could he expect solvers to know it? I, of course, thought that it would be and that he could, but he disagreed. Insight 2 is related. Because they patrol the borders of common knowledge and proper usage, crosswords have become hot zones in today's culture wars. What words and phrases are puzzle-worthy is ultimately a fraught question. Are crosswords in mainstream newspapers too white, too straight, too male? Can words stripped of syntax carry all this baggage? And will diversifying the demographics of crossword constructors necessarily diversify the words included in the puzzles themselves? The history of the crossword puzzle offers a dramatically clear view onto the politics of language, how and why words become such political objects, drawing communities together and fracturing them with equal force. As an experiment, I've compiled a list of words from peers of mine, fellow cruciverbalists, that have been rejected by white male editors at wide circulation newspapers for being too niche or not relevant enough for the editor's imagined audience of solvers. These words include bell hooks, matcha tea, riot girl, Laverne Cox, and Marie Kondo, among others. Of course, a pattern develops when looking at these entries. They have their origins in woman-produced and non-white cultures. By trying to institute a policy of inclusion, looking to address the largest audience without including so-called niche words in their grids, many editors have established a tacit policy of exclusion. In the past 5 years or so, efforts have been made to redress these exclusions, including diversifying editorial staffs at newspapers' puzzle sections, and new initiatives meant to mentor constructors from underrepresented communities. Those of us committed to these diversifying efforts are often left to wonder, are we taking ourselves and the puzzle way too seriously? Why politicize a pastime? And yet, as my book details, the puzzle is an intensified microcosm for questions about common usage and its politics that plague all forms of representation. Insight 3. The 1920s witnessed a crossword craze in the United States. Dictionaries were reportedly placed next to Bibles in hotel rooms. Baseball managers worried that the grid would replace the diamond as America's favorite pastime. In cartoons, novelty songs, and even on Broadway, the new woman of the 1920s became an unexpected emblem of the crossword craze. Her desires to date, to work, and to vote were just as inscrutable to patriarchy as the 15 by 15 square grid. The dangerous fantasy of the puzzle woman is perhaps most famously registered in the 1925 novelty song, Crossword Mama. A puzzling woman, she devotes herself to the crossword as a proxy for other fashions of the time. Like the flapper, she is liberated from the corsets and the customs of the Victorian age. A double crosser, she is not to be trusted. The song's lyrics start, "You call me honey, that means bee. Looks like I'll be stung, no doubt." The frankly corny conceit extends across 9 verses. "I heard you mention butcher, that means meat. Who you gonna meet tonight?" But like the Sphinx before her, the crossword mama solicits a solution. "Crossword mama, you puzzle me," the chorus concludes, "but Papa's gonna figure you out." There are hundreds of other Jazz Age relics that conflate the flapper and the crossword as icons of the zeitgeist. In these images, the puzzle represents the enigma of female desire and fuels the intimacy between men and women in an otherwise chaste culture of heterosexual courtship. It allows verbal and physical taboos to be breached as members of the opposite sex say 4-letter words to each other, cuddling around the newspaper page. "You naughty boy, it couldn't be that word," reads the caption on a postcard featuring 2 young solvers, a blushing man and a woman clutching her breast. By the dual logic of the crossword craze, the woman is the puzzle, and the puzzle brings solvers closer to their desire. The puzzle, in other words, is a sex object. Insight 4. Historically, crosswords have been created with graph paper and pencil. Since the 1990s, constructors have increasingly used software to create their grids. The processes couldn't be more different. Instead of working to crosswords in her notebook, as I did when I first started writing puzzles up until I was 25, the digital constructor is constantly updating her word list, a database of words ranked according to how puzzle-worthy they are, which feeds an algorithm that populates the grid on its own. The constructor still intervenes in meaningful ways. Most importantly, she still writes the clues. But the puzzle's grid is no longer a plotted space that she enters so much as an ongoing activity. Instead of focusing only on words as material clumps of letters divorced from their meanings, she thinks almost exclusively about meanings. How a word or phrase makes her feel, where she was when she first encountered it, the context and communities in which she uses it. The development and rise of constructing software has meaningfully changed the kind of work the puzzle maker does, and also the kind of person who does it. Many contemporary constructors come from STEM fields and are interested in crossword constructing as a natural language processing problem. Can a computer make a better crossword than a person can? Like so many industries before it, though, including the history of computer programming itself, the work that a computer can do as well or better than a person has neatly overlapped with the kind of work that women have been encouraged to do. Just as women were the earliest computer programmers, edged out of that job once their work of encoding and debugging could be performed by the computer itself, there is reason to believe that women have been edged out of crossword constructing, now that the computer does the weaving with language that has historically been coded as women's work. Insight 5. The women who populate this feminist history of the crossword puzzle, developing its rules and innovating within them, shared a desire to work in a culture that was not properly their own. Many of them found the terms woman and worker, or woman and writer, simply incompatible. They sought ways to accommodate their ambition and their appetites for a career, for power, for knowledge, within the limiting terms of femininity during their lives. They developed punishing relationships to their own body and the body of language, trying to discipline both into a relation that would spell success for them in the rigid terms of their social worlds. Sometimes they developed eating disorders, alcoholism, and other coping mechanisms that isolated them from other workers and other women. It's not a stretch to imagine the crossword puzzles that occupied them as yet another coping mechanism for their lives under patriarchy. The first editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle, Margaret Ferrer, never identified her work as a job. It was something she did to occupy her mind, in addition to her work as a mother of three and the wife of publisher John C. Ferrer, co-founder of Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux. Before she met John, Margaret was the editor of the Simon & Schuster puzzle books, which were the very first books, all bestsellers, that Simon & Schuster produced. She invested the money she earned with these books and used it to finance FSG in its earliest years. In brief, even though Margaret Ferrer didn't identify as a career woman or culture worker, there would be no New York Times crossword puzzle, no Simon & Schuster, and no FSG without her puzzles. Margaret is just one of the women I write about in this book. Others are suffragists, lesbian separatists, Lacanian psychoanalysts, and one self-taught Joyce scholar, all of whom shaped the feminist history of the crossword puzzle and reveal its thorny but rich relationship to the politics of language. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoy The Riddles of the Sphinx.
Thank you, Anna. That was Anna Schechtman with five big ideas from The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. You might also like our book bite for The Puzzler, One Man's Quest to Solve the Most Baffling Puzzles Ever, From Crosswords to Jigsaws to the Meaning of Life by A.J. Jacobs. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.